Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Green Egg Five Rivers Radio Hour, hosted by Ariel Monserrat and Michael R. Gorman. Unfortunately, Ariel is not able to be with us today, so we're just going to have to muddle through with just me. I'm really excited about our guest tonight. Her name is Sylvie. She is the owner of the Pentacle Project on Facebook. She's also an assistant to the editor of Green Egg Magazine, which is the oldest neo-pagan magazine in the world, as well as a webmaster for the Green Egg site. She is what is known as a granny witch and lives in the southern Appalachians in Tennessee. And we're, among other things, going to find out what exactly a granny witch is tonight. So welcome, Sylvie.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. We're actually getting a little bit of rain out here in California, which we've desperately needed. So things are good right now. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm sitting here watching the skies, waiting for a second wave of severe thunderstorms, and they're calling for tornadoes. So if you happen to lose me, you know, I may not be able to get back.
Well, is there any way you can arrange with, Tyrannus, the Celtic weather god, to send some of that rain out our way, you know, relieve you guys of the pressure?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
So you are based in the Appalachians of Tennessee. I grew up for 4 years. My father was military, and we were stationed in the Appalachians of Western Maryland. It's one of the parts of the country that I absolutely love. And anybody who doesn't know what prompts the folklore about enchanted forests and just needs to go to Appalachia to find that out. So tell us, what is Appalachian mountain magic?
Okay, well, you have to understand, I've been raised and still live in the southern Appalachians, so I know nothing about the northern part of it, but the southern
just
Appalachian...
Just as magic, slightly different accent is all.
Well, yeah, I imagine so. What it is it's the basic culture around southern Appalachia here. It's a way of life that's been handed down through the generations. And in my area, and I'm not sure about the north, but in my area, Appalachian mountain magic is family specific. So So you won't find, you know, two households that practice the craft in exactly the same manner.
Wow. You know, if people don't often think about traditions like that being passed on in America, you know, we think about the old countries when we think about that stuff. So it's really exciting to learn about one that is just right here in our backyard. So it's based on families, kind of like you hear about the hereditary witches and hereditary druids over in Europe.
That's one way you could put it. You know, it is. I guess it is hereditary. As far as its age goes, you know, many of us here can trace ancestors back, you know, to the original countries they migrated from.
Right,
My ancestors, a good portion of them were born right here in America from the beginning. I've got a lot of Native American in my lineage.
Nice.
And Scott-Irish, and there's some English somewhere or another. My aunt has all this written down, and I need to get a copy. But
so you've got people of the circle from both sides of the family. That's awesome.
Right.
So is mountain magic then, is it kind of a a combination of some of the Native American traditions and some of the European traditions? What are the roots?
Yes, it's the Cherokee and Choctaw were native to this area. The Cherokee held slaves, much like the old Southern white men did.
Uh-huh.
So you've got a mixture of you've got some Celtic tendencies, of which the Celtic and the Native American, and specifically the Cherokee, their traditions were a lot alike. And then you've got some hoodoo mixed in there as well. And you may find other, you know, depending on, like I said, who or where your family came from, if some, you know, came from another country through the northern part and migrated south, you might find some Italian in there. You might find a mixture of anything, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as in with most things in America, we're such a mix of things, which I think is great, you know, cross-pollination. I had a friend who was a Cherokee elder. He died a couple years ago, and he said he and some of the other Native American elders kind of chuckle when they hear most white people talk about their history because, you know, a lot of people come to Native Americans to study their spirituality, not realizing that there's a similar tradition, the Celtic tradition out of Europe. And he said, and all the tribes along the East Coast have stories about the other people of the circle, he called them, you know, the people from Europe who came over who were practitioners of the old ways. And they were interacting, you know, long before Leif Erikson. So tell us about, as much as you can, I don't know if there's stuff that traditions you can't talk about, but tell us about the how mountain magic was manifest in your family. How did it weave into your lives?
Well, it's just a part of life. It's an everyday thing. Our tradition is passed down through storytelling and as well as hands-on experience.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't even know it had a name to it until I was up in my 40s. Honestly.
Wow.
You know, it was just, to me, I'd been doing it all of my life, and then suddenly someone handed me a Dane McCoy's book, and I was reading through that, and I went, wait a minute, I'm recognizing some of this.
I was kind of similar with the Druid Path. I was like, oh, wow, there's a name for all that stuff I did as a kid that I just thought was stuff I did, you know. That's
really
cool.
I mean, not only as a kid, I mean, it's just a way of life, you know, and we look at everything as magical or having energy to it. And,
uh-huh.
Everything from cooking, your sweeping, your gardening, whatever you may make as far as being artistic, our music, you name it. You know, it's got significance.
You know, I love when you talk about it being just a way of life. One of my favorite movies is called The Songcatcher. I don't know if you've heard of it. This woman who was an expert in folk music from the Northern Isles, England, Wales, Cornwall, Ireland, Scotland, and she got cheated out of a degree. You know, it was days when women weren't treated well in academia. And she left to go stay with her sister, and I'm pretty sure it was in Tennessee. And she heard this little girl one day just singing this traditional Northern Isles folk song. And she went up to her and said, well, where did you learn that song? And the little girl was like, from my mama. It's like, well, did your mother study European music? I mean, where did she learn it? It was like, from her mama. Where did she learn it? From her mama. And then from her mama before then. And this woman is just amazed that this folk music is almost identical to what she'd been studying in the Northern Isles. I always tell people with rock music, we got the melodies from the Northern Isles and the rhythms from Africa, and they just mixed all together in the Appalachian Mountains and gave us what we got today.
Yeah,
that similar perspective applies to the music as well. And I guess there's not really a disconnection between the magic and the music where your tradition is concerned. So tell us a little bit about, you know, if we were to visit a home that had practiced mountain magic, what sort of things would we see that would define that for us?
Well, the first and foremost thing that you would see traveling these mountains is a porch or a doorway painted what we call paint blue. That would be a baby blue, a very light pastel blue. And that is done to keep ghosts from following you inside your home. They can't go past the paint blue. And, of course, you've heard of the horseshoes that look like a letter U.
Right.
Your luck won't drain out. Inside the home, I'm sure everybody would recognize someone, you know, using salt. They put some on their palm, throw it over their shoulder.
Right, right.
And
You know, it's funny. I've been in my own research in the Celtic world that, you know, one of the things that characterized the Celtic world is they had an amazingly skilled mining class of people who, I mean, they actually had a better diet than most of the rest of Europe because they learned to preserve stuff with salt for a long time. So, you know, salt's been a sacred thing for a very, very long time, and I imagine both the tradition and in the roots of the tradition. So, you know, people think of it as just a superstition, but actually it's a way of honoring a great deal of history.
Yes. And around here you also... I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. It was great to hear you use the word haints. We had a Samhain Halloween masquerade ball here at Five Rivers last year, and one of the things I had up was this sign with this skeleton hand pointing, and it said haints. And all these Californians are like, what is that word? What's a haint? I've never heard of a haint. spirits. So I thought, you know, having grown up there, I thought everybody knew that word, but I guess not.
No. Even the mountain speech itself, it deserves a dictionary written specifically to define some of these words.
One of the first plays I ever wrote, I specifically chose an Appalachian dialect because I wanted to be able to write in really flowery language like Shakespeare, but there aren't a lot of dialects in English nowadays that you can do that with except Appalachian dialects, you know. It's more in four good looks and right smart walk between here and there. I mean, that's so much more fun than saying it's quite a ways. You know, and I love some of those folk language forms that you guys. Can you think of any that you grew up with your family? Some of those ways of saying things in Appalachia.
Oh mercy! I'm going to have to think a little bit because my grandmother pushed me to become as educated as she called it. one of the sayings that she used to use quite a bit was he's about as useful as a tit on a boar hog.
that puts a memorable picture in the mind. It's hard to forget stuff when you do that. I love it. What is the one about the more nervous than a cat in a room full of rocking chairs? That's one of them.
Yeah, more nervous than a cat in a room full of rocking chairs. Yeah, long-tailed cat.
You know, I used to teach high school English, and of course, most of my colleagues were constantly trying to, you know, get the students to speak in something sort of like standard English, although misunderstanding that standard English is a written dialect, not a spoken one. And I was always telling my students, like, no, cherish your dialect, hang on to it. It's your history, it's your family, and it's fun, you know. Just learn standard English is just another one, and then you'll have, you know, two dialects that you're expert in. But an Appalachian dialect is one of those ones that's just so magical.
Yes. One thing that I was stigmatized as a young girl, I my father was in the military, so I grew up half part of the time in Florida down around Jacksonville Beach and the Gulf Coast, and part of the time here in Tennessee. And I found that when I was around the military base, I was fine, but if I went out into the metro area, just the way I talk, people assumed that I was dumber than dirt.
Oh, yeah, because of stereotypes about the dialect.
Yes, mountain people are not stupid by any stretch.
Well, you know, it's the people that think standard English is something you speak. I mean, how do you pronounce period and question mark? I mean, it's a written dialect that tries to get across what you can do with expression and pauses and stuff in spoken English, but nobody speaks it. At 1 year when I said that to students, the librarian said, "I speak standard English." I said, "No, you don't." She goes, "Uh-huh." I'm like, "Uh-huh, that's not even a word, let alone a complete sentence." And I've been to parties with you. I know you don't talk in complete sentences. Nobody would stick around long enough to listen to you. So there's so much misunderstanding, and I think we lose a cultural richness when we try to take those dialects away from kids. You know, they just need to learn the other one that's the standard one that we all understand, and it's all copacetic. So.
Yes. I mean, I grew up, of course, down around the military base. I encountered people from all over the world, and I absolutely love to hear people speak with what you call the drawl of where they're from.
Absolutely, absolutely. I had a young student, a young black woman in high school who's she was extremely bright. She understood everything, and participation in discussions in class. She just had insightful things to say, but she was flunking the class because she wouldn't do any of the work. And I finally questioned her one day and said, "What's going on? I know you understand this stuff." And she said, "Well, I don't really like talking in white people English because of my grandma." And I'm like, "What?" And it turns out that she was from East Oakland. Her mother was a prostitute. Her father was a drug dealer. And her grandmother marched out there one time, brought her into the valley here just to keep her safe and give her a better life. So her grandmother was like the center of her universe. And she thought that her grandmother talked wrong, but she was so loyal to her grandmother that she wasn't going to disparage her by, speaking more standard English. And I explained about dialects. I said, "No, that's your history." I said, there's verb tenses in black English that we don't have. You know, it be boiling. I mean, it was boiling, it is boiling now, and it will be boiling in a little while. We don't have that in standard English. I said, "Cherish your dialect." And she said that one of the things that is just stuck in my brain, she said, "Mr. Gorman, nobody ever told me that. I thought me and my grandma talked wrong." I'm like, God, how we rob kids of their heritage by doing that. Sorry, I get kind of passionate about this. You're supposed to be the one talking. But so back to the mountain magic. You call yourself a granny witch? Is that
yes.
So what
yes,
exactly, how would you define?
Well, I adopted the term simply because, I think it describes a majority of the people here. And by the way, there are many, many women here that practice granny magic, but they don't know it. They're just completely unaware. It's highly Christianized here, but yet, you walk into some of the, I guess, what you call the Free Will Baptist or the Pentecostal churches, and their way of even worshiping what they call God is, they're using their Appalachian magic in these churches.
I love it.
And
it's similar in good Catholic women in Ireland that are always practicing, the old ways without realizing it. They've just incorporated into their Christianity.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. When you've got a belief system that is rooted in nature, it's pretty hard for people to leave that behind, because it's around them all the time. And yeah, it's kind of funny to see how they get mixed into the newer urban religions. Go ahead.
I have to say,
by the way, speaking of dialect, that, you know, California, you probably notice we talk a little faster. And, you know, when I hear that, you know, you're being so elegant and polite and waiting a pause in between questions, whereas here in California, you have to be careful with people, like, jumping on top of what you're saying instead of politely pausing. So I'm sorry for stepping on your most elegant dialect. But so go ahead, talking about you as the granny witch and what that is.
Well, what I was going to add there was about the snake handling. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. That's not in granny magic.
Where does that come from? Do you know?
I think it's on the other side of crazy somewhere. Honestly, my opinion.
Yeah, I've always loved snakes, but I've always respected them. And the idea of picking them up and irritating them just does not sound like a good idea to me at all.
That's the whole premise of granny magic, mountain magic, is that you respect nature, and part of respect is you understand that snake can kill you.
Right.
Now, you know, it's not that we don't incorporate elements of the snake in there, per se. You find a snake skin. You know, you can use that magically. You find one that's passed on. You can, I don't advise anyone out there to do this without proper training, but you can remove their fangs and use those as magical elements, you see. Go ahead.
I think it's a great irony that people who supposedly are practicing old ways are basically doing what the mainstream culture says, and I will make nature do what I want it to do. I will dominate nature. And the true nature-based belief systems don't do that. It's a matter of respect and finding your harmony with it. Do you find that in your practice as well?
You're not going to make nature do anything. You have to work beside her.
Yes. You know, every time I hear politicians doing some grand scheme to try to fix, you know, watershed or whatever, it's like, you know, just look at nature and take your cues from her.
Yes. I mean, with the Tennessee Valley here, they have done a good job at engineering to work with the ebb and flow of the hills and mountains.
Right.
I'm glad someone had sense enough to build a dam in the valley instead of up on a mountain, you know.
Right.
You never know with people.
It's like California, you know, you have these very fragile hills along the coast because of the earthquake faults, and you know, they're basically just ocean bottom scraped up and prone to landslides. So what do? We cut out pieces of them and stick heavy houses on top of them. Like,
no.
How does that even remotely make sense? So in the area, is what would you say is the difference between somebody who is more conscious of being a granny witch and doing the mountain magic like you are, and the like Christian women who practice it are not really aware of its roots. Is it more pervasive in your life when you're more conscious of it, or is it just a matter of not knowing the history? Go ahead.
I've been a part of both worlds, and I think I've been fortunate in that my grandmother insisted that I be raised in a Christian environment, but yet at home she was teaching me these granny ways, you know, just ways of, you know, everyday life. She would point things out, well, this is how we do this, and she would tell me why this is how we do this. And when I was smaller, she didn't tell me this. She didn't tell me this up until she was about ready to pass away. But she wanted me to be able to pick my own path. And
that's awesome.
For the women who practice, you know, the witchery in a Christian environment, they honestly are not aware that this is what they're doing. They're doing this because they learned it from their mother, and their mother learned it from her mother, and right. You know, it's just a way of life. But for someone like me, or anyone who is aware of it, it's more than just a spiritual experience per se. You become aware of all the various energies out here and how they interact. You become aware of what action brings what type of a reaction. So, per se, I wanted to go out and use a tree branch as a wand. You know, I know what type of tree that is. I know what type of energy can flow through that. I know both the positive and negative of it. Whereas someone who was raised in a Christian household, that's just a stick.
Yeah. Well, you know, I find it really wonderful. You talk about the stereotype of people thinking that you're not intelligent, and yet those kinds of traditions are very science-based. It comes from observing nature and seeing how nature works and drawing some conclusions and experimenting things. So really, your ancestors were scientists of a type of your culture. And it's crazy that people think of that as stupid, because you know the fact that we're not learning from nature is going to be our greatest downfall.
Yes, it is. And you know, one thing that I found out not through my family tradition, but through just going back and reading the various parts that I have recognized within our tradition, is that the Cherokee are very adept at plants and their what you can use these plants for as far as your health and for food. But I was astounded to find out that a lot of the common, I'm not synthetic now, but common natural-based medications that we have that are on the market came from the Cherokee people sharing what they knew about plants, because a lot of what we started out with as pharmaceuticals are derived from natural plants and, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, like aspirin from the willow, you know.
Right,
people think
exactly.
It came from a lab, but no, it came from the willow tree.
The willow tree. And, of course, everybody knows what ginseng is. And ginseng can treat a whole array of ailments. I grew up chewing on ginseng root. You know, if I had a sick stomach, it is so bitter. But my grandmother would say, here, put this in your mouth. And, you know, she'd say, put it in there and gum on it a while, although I had teeth, you know.
Another one of those wonderful expressions. Put it in and gum on it. I love it.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that mainstream Western culture does is, you know, to make everybody think they came up with it, they just take the ginseng and chop it up and make it into something that doesn't look anything like a plant so that we don't know where it came from.
This is true. It grows... it doesn't grow in as much as it used to anymore because it's been over harvested, but there are still a few places that you can, if you like to go on nature hikes and into the deep woods, you can still find it growing.
Wow. So what are some of the other medicinal plants that a granny witch would be familiar with?
Well, we have the plain old dandelion yard weed, they call it. That is a wonderful diuretic, and all you have to do is go out, dig you a few up, wash them, and boil them up in some water. If you're retaining water, you just, you know, drink you a half a cup or so. I'd say, give you specifics. You want to go out and you want to find like a medium-sized plant, which is about 2 years old, 2-3 years old, and you want to take about four of those roots and chop them up, put them in about 2 cups of water and let them boil slow. You will bring them to a boil and then let it simmer for an hour or so, so that it reduces the liquid, and you can pour that into a medicine jar or what have you, and just take a couple of tablespoons every day until your problem disappears.
Wow. That's so much cheaper than going to the store and buying something.
Yes, and it's safer for you in the fact that if you go buy a package of Diurex, you are going to be traveling to the bathroom when you really don't need to.
Right.
Whereas with dandelion root, it sheds the water little by little. I mean, it takes a while to work. You know, so many people want something to work instantly. Well, our bodies
right.
aren't made that way. We are not. Our bodies, you don't just snap your fingers and something happens. It has a process. So
right.
where you'll go to the bathroom normally, but you might go a little more than what you did. But it's not going to be so much as, oh, if I don't get there now, there's going to be a slick floor around here.
Right, right. Well, I have found that, I don't know if you use raspberry leaf for tea, but I've found that when I have the opposite problem, diarrhea, that it, a couple cups of raspberry leaf tea takes care of it. It's the same kind of thing. It doesn't create, you know, a problem in the other direction or be so quick and extreme. It just gently takes care of the problem. And I don't know if you've heard, I'm sure you have heard of Janet Farrer, who is, she's in Ireland right now. She's one of the early practitioners of modern neo-paganism. And we were at her house in Ireland, and my stomach was bothering me. And my partner went up to her and said, Janet, Michael's stomach's bothering him. Do you have any raspberry leaf tea? And she goes, no, I have some Imodium AB. what kind of a witch are you? We ask for raspberry leaf, and you offer a money of media. He said, well, there's plenty down in the bogs. You're just welcome to go down and pick it. And,
yeah.
Man, that talk about a potent cure picked from the bogs. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So what are some others? I'm really fascinated by, you know, the things that are around us we could be using but we don't know about.
Well, there's the wild cherry. They're just really tiny cherries. They're not exactly microscopic. Maybe they're about as big around as your pinky fingernail. You can use this alone, or you can combine it with ginseng and honey and whatever, you know, whatever your taste involves. That is very good for especially mixed with the honey, it is very good for soothing a sore throat, and it helps ease a cough so that you can heal. Of course, the honey having the antibiotic effect.
Yeah.
And if you run into poison ivy, there is a plant out here called plantain. You can, and it grows wild out here too. So if you come in contact with poison ivy, you just find some plantain, bruise it real well and rub it over the area where you exposed, and it just you're not going to have a breakout from the poison ivy.
Wow. Yeah, I was.
And,
I didn't have an allergy to poison ivy when I was back there, but poison oak here in California, I just have to look at it and I'll break out.
Oh my! I'm not affected by either one for some reason, but I think that's because
right.
I've handled it. Pretty much all throughout my life.
Right.
And
I have been told by somebody once that if you have a plant that you have a negative reaction to, that very often the thing that's the antidote for it tends to grow very close to where it does. Is that the case?
Yes, that's true. Unless you run into one of the really baneful plants, and we do have those. We have two plants growing here, let me think of the name of it. One is called Queen Anne's Lace, which is not poisonous, but then the other one is hemlock. And I'm sure everyone's familiar with hemlock.
Yeah.
Good old Socrates.
This is where you absolutely must know what you're dealing with. There is no antidote for hemlock that I know of unless you go to the Poison Control Center. Don't spend time thinking, oh, well, maybe this will work, and start eating something. Just don't do that.
Go to the Poison Center.
Yes. And take the plant with you.
Yeah. Or you'll be, you know, talking one-on-one with Socrates in person because you'll be gone. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we have that here as well. And for the longest time, I was afraid to pick wild fennel along the rivers here in the Sacramento Valley because it took me a while to recognize the difference between the hemlock and the fennel, in particularly in their smaller stages and stuff. So I wasn't going to take any chances.
Yeah, I mean, it's best to know absolutely what you're doing. I mean, we have stupid teenagers here. I guess we have stupid teenagers everywhere, but here a few years back, some of them learned that Jimson weed was a hallucinogenic, and we had instance after instance where they were going and grabbing these plants and drying them out and just swallowing the seeds by the pods, you know. Now, these pods, they're very thorny on the outside, and they have a multitude of tiny black seeds on the inside. Not microscopic, not tiny like, say, a coleus. More like a mustard seed, about that size, on the inside of them. And they are, before you reach that hallucinogenic stage, you're going to poison yourself.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think a lot of people have this misconception that if it's natural and herbal, that it's never dangerous, which is kind of crazy. What are some of the plants that could be dangerous in great quantities but are medicinal in smaller quantities? Do you have some examples in your area of that?
Well, actually, all of them are. This is, you know, even the dandelion that I was just talking about, if you mix too much of that and you'll concentrate that down, you could run the risk of dehydration, and from dehydration you can develop all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the cherry. Now, you don't ever want to use wild cherry leaves, though, even though I should have specified prior, this is wild cherry bark, not the leaves. And the fruits are harmless. You can make jelly out of those and different things. But never, ever use wild cherry leaves to medicate anything. Those are poisonous. So
we actually had a case here in Sacramento where a radio station had one of those goofy contests they do, and they were offering a free Wi-Fi to somebody who could drink tons of water and never use the bathroom, and the person that lasted long, and one of the contestants died of water poisoning. Lots of people didn't even know you could get poisoned by water. But
oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you just imagine it, that all of that water in the system, basically taking all the minerals and nutrients out of your blood and everything to try to balance itself, it would just, like, leave you, you know, completely devoid. But yeah, it was really sad. She wanted to get this for her kids, and she ended up dying as a result of the contest. So that's one of the things I talked about. Janet, that she emphasizes about herbalism, that anything could be poison if you take too much of it. So speaking of, if somebody wanted to learn more about the mountain magic tradition, some of the herbalism, some of the, you know, rituals and things, is there a place to go where they could find that out, or the books about it?
Well, there is and there isn't. The information is scattered. If you can find a series of books, I suggest the Foxfire books, because someone spent a lot of time compiling information from different older mountain people, and it has a wealth of information in there. As you read through these books, you will recognize any of the traditions out there that are commonly known. As you're reading through these books, you'll say, "Hey, I recognize that." So you can see how the vein runs. You know, speaking of mining, you can see how that vein runs through the rest of it.
Yeah.
Dane McCoy wrote a book that she touches briefly on a lot of it. She is dealing mainly with the folklore and things, but there is a lot of information within the folklore and even in the fairy tales we've heard growing up.
I think probably Appalachia is richer in... I used to teach a folklore class as well as sort of an amateur folklorist, and I don't think there's a part of the country that's richer than Appalachia in folklore. It's a phenomenal place to study.
As growing up, you know, my grandma and grandpa used to tell all kinds of stories, and of course, being, you know, my dad in the military, he was Navy, and sailors are just famous for telling these tall tales.
Oh, yeah.
It took me quite a while to realize, you know, that my grandma and grandpa was giving me little secrets and things with the stories they would tell.
That's great. Yeah, I'm a storyteller myself, and I bemoan the fact that modern academia has lost track of the story as a method for teaching, because it's one of the best. It gets people to remember stuff. It puts it in a context. It's all the things that educational theory says we need to do to get kids to learn, and yet, you know, we look down on people who teach through storytelling.
I'm sure you've noticed, if you can capture a child's interest, then whatever you're using to capture their interest, you can teach them everything.
Oh, yeah. You know, I see people that get these Baby Einstein videos for their kids and are a more formal type teaching, and those are wonderful. But with my son, I just threw him in a backpack and took him everywhere and talked about everything that we ran across and never talked baby talk. And, you know, the kid his vocabulary tested postgraduate when he was in sixth grade, just because, you know, I told him the stories of stuff constantly, and he remembered it all, and it was fun to learn. You know, that's something that we've lost in a lot of the schools, is just the fun of learning. To reiterate, if people want to find out some of this kind of tradition, the Foxfire books are good.
Yes.
And is Dane McCoy, is that the Foxfire books, or is it different books that Dane McCoy wrote?
No, Dane McCoy wrote, that's completely different, although she does mention the Firefox series, and there's some of her book was based on the Firefox series, and she has that in the footnotes. And Byron Ballard is another one, if anyone's familiar with her. I believe she's from somewhere over around East Tennessee, but she practices a lot of mountain magic.
Okay. And that's Byron Ballard, B-A-L-L-A-R-D?
Yes.
Cool. So the three sources people can go to are Foxfire books, Dana McCoy's books, and Byron Ballard's books. And your website, Byron.
Byron, you can find her on Facebook, and she has all that information on her Facebook page.
Excellent.
And there is also... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There is also Doris Morrison.
It's that speed of talking thing again. Sorry. Go ahead.
There is also Dorothy Morrison, and she is known as the original Wicked Witch.
Oh,
but
cool.
Within her books is a wealth of Appalachian ingredients, I'll say.
Nice, nice.
And I imagine that people, if they read carefully, can read about a lot of different kinds of Appalachian lore and you know, extract the magic out of it because it's so intertwined. Of course, you'd have to have some sort of a basis for knowing what to extract. But, so tell us about your Facebook page. What do we find there?
Well, specifically on my personal page, you'll just, you know, find cute cats and some, a little bit of sick humor at times. And I spend a majority of my time on the putting up things for the Pinnacle Project and the Green Egg. With the Green Egg, I generally try to stick with whatever Ariel is going to publish in the magazine. The Pinnacle Project, although it is pagan, there are more than just pagans that visit the page. We have a lot of atheist and agnostic people that visit because we run political pieces. We run things that happen. Just it's a lot of news pieces, you know, but a firm believer that even though we may be pagan, but we can't just discount what is going on around us in any facet of life. You know,
we do that to our own peril, you know, ignoring what's happening around us.
Right.
And I think part of the nature-based consciousness is the understanding that, you know, you're trying to find wisdom everywhere and weave things together. So if your circle is small and doesn't allow access to something, it doesn't encompass something, you need to make your circle bigger so that you can, you know, use your wisdom everywhere and draw your wisdom from everywhere.
Exactly. And a lot of people forget that nature also includes the human nature.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of my liberal friends, environmentalists in California, forget that we too are a part of the ecosystem, and Mother Nature, I mean, if we screw up too badly, we're going to lose our part on the planet, but nature doesn't want us gone. It wants us just balanced with everything else.
Exactly, and, you know, I'm one that I pay attention to energy. And the human brain is capable of producing some extraordinary energy. And, you know, I've had people argue with me on that, but, you know, you can measure it with an EEG. You can walk into a room, and some people say, oh, the tension was so thick you could cut it with a knife. Well, that's energy.
Exactly. Well, I always love it when I hear people say, well, I only believe what I can see it with my own eyes. I'm like, so you don't believe in microwaves or radio waves or laser or justice or love? The wind. It's like there's a lot of stuff we can't see with our eyes that we feel the energy or observe the energy in some other way.
Exactly. And, heat, you know. That's, and heat is a mixture of what kind of what is the wave that comes off the sun?
Well, you know, heat can be created by a bunch of different ways. But basically, it's just taking things and speeding them up, you know, and whatever, whether it's a laser or a fan or whatever you do, it's actually pretty simple, and we try to separate that from the simplicity and the elegance of the natural world, you know.
Right.
There's a Celtic writer whose name is escaping me right at the moment, but he referred to magic. So, you know, people think of magic as supernatural. He said, "I prefer to think of it as superbly natural. It's the part of what's out there that most people just aren't paying attention to. The ways to move energy around that most people don't know because they've never tried."
Exactly. I mean, I'm a firm believer that science will one day totally define or continue to define what we call magic now. You know, for instance, you know, back in prehistoric times, if we'd have shown up with a Bic lighter, can you imagine how those people would have reacted?
Oh, yeah, we would have been instant gods.
Yeah. If now we understand, well, you know, that's a piece of metal scraping on flint, and there's, you know, some fuel. And I'm a fan of quantum physics, although
yes.
I can't speak the language to you. I don't know why, but I can look at what a quantum physicist is doing when he illustrates it and completely understand it. And I believe that, you know, there's going to come a day we're going to be able to understand why our spirits leave our bodies and go to wherever they go through quantum physics.
Right. Well, I had really interesting experience. My ex, as a genius, has a doctorate in quantum computation. And so I would go to these parties with people who were quantum physicists and people trying to reinvent the computer to work in quantum physics research with the probabilities and stuff. And we had these wonderful conversations because all of a sudden science is coming back around to some of the stuff that the old way said, like, you know, say you can perceive something to be there when it's actually over there. And I said, oh, my Druid ancestor said that. Or, you know, you can't do an experiment without your presence affecting the outcome. And I said, oh, yeah, one of the rules about doing magic is know what your intent is because it will affect the outcome of what you do. So I was having these great, and, you know, they started coming to me. I said, okay, quantum physics says this. What do the mystics say about this? And, you know, we get our wisdom from nature. It's all the same wisdom. You know, I love
yes,
it.
And I mean, that's what they're studying is nature. It's how these atoms and all these little waves are interacting with each other. You know, I don't know what you call them,
but
when
you know,
I see
and,
it in a picture.
And in science's defense, sometimes they're just catching up with the old ways, and it's because, you know, Julius Caesar started burning all the libraries in Europe so people wouldn't know about the old ways. So kind of like Western culture had to start all over after they, you know, killed the witches and burned the libraries. And I find it ironic when I hear people treating scientists as if they're these horrible people that are in opposition to religion and spirituality and say, okay, well, anybody who honors the creation, I mean, the scientists should be our high priests. They spend their entire lives studying the natural world. You know, why would you denigrate those people? What similar sounds to what basically what granny witches do. It's woven into your whole life.
Yeah, I grew up too. You mentioned in salt. You know, we were completely self-sufficient. You know, except for my grandmother did, instead of growing her own grain and putting it at the mill. You know, we would go buy things like flour and sugar and things like that. But
yeah,
as far as our vegetables and meat and all of that went, even our soap, we made that on the farm. And just the process of doing all of that is, you know, there's magic in all of it. There's energy that happens, especially with our animals, because we always made sure our animals were very comfortable and thanked them, you know, for providing us with food. There was nothing wasted. Nothing.
You know, if we could just learn that one lesson as a culture and start to live sustainably on the land, man, the world would be such a different place.
Yes. I hear all kinds of things about, you know, instead of eating real butter, which contains so much fat and cholesterol, use this product here. Well, there's a lot to be said for real butter and for the fats that occur naturally in animals, and I'm talking about fats that aren't full of hormones and antibiotics and things like that. The fat of an animal contains minerals that the human body needs. You know,
yeah, there have been studies coming out recently about, first of all, that the benefits or the danger of certain fats with high blood pressure and clogged arteries is been overstated or not directed correctly, but that they are starting to realize that we do lose a lot of the benefits with the artificial stuff. And like everything else, it's got to be in moderation if it's going to be healthy.
Yes, of course. But, you know, one way to look at it is everything that's natural in its proper place, your body knows what to do with that. Whereas something that's totally artificial, it goes in your body and your body's going, where in the hell am I going to put that?
What the hell is this?
Yeah, so this is where you get the plaque in the arteries, because a lot of people don't understand that the plaque in the arteries is literally in between the inside part of the vein and the outside part of the vein. It's not something that can go in the tunnel and scrape away.
Right.
So your body places it inside the vein wall, and that's what closes things down and causes heart disease.
Yeah. Well, even things like, you know, now they're finding that one of the reasons that, you know, the French eat a high-fat diet and don't have the heart attacks that Americans do, because they also drink wine, which actually is good for the heart. They're finding out coffee in moderation is good for the heart. All these things that come from the plants, suddenly we're rediscovering that they're good for us.
Yeah, exactly.
I imagine you could have told them that years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up eating, you know, my grandmother cooked with lard, and she used both that from the cattle and from pigs. And we didn't have problems. You know, my grandparents did not die of heart disease. They died of old age. You know, they just gracefully left.
My mother, who was actually the age of most of my friends' grandparents, because I was the youngest of seven in a big Irish Catholic family, she just thought people were crazy that they bought oil at the store when you just had to save the bacon grease from the traditional Irish breakfast every morning.
My grandmother used a lot of bacon grease in a lot of things she cooked. And I mean, people come from miles around to eat her food.
Well, I remember the first time I was in junior high school before I ever tasted a taco, because where we grew up in the back east in Jersey in that area, they didn't have Mexican food. And my first taco was at the Douglas County Fair in southern Arizona, right near the border, out of this little trailer with this woman with this, you know, white apron with grease on it. And I didn't even know what they were. I had to stand and listen to what other people were ordering. I took one bite of it, and it's like the hallelujah chorus went off. It sounds like we are getting, like the Academy Award people, we're getting music off. Is there anything you want to say before we disappear?
Well, just everybody have a blessed rest of the evening, and it was good talking to you.
Thank you so much, Sylvia. It was really wonderful hearing down-to-earth wisdom and medicine. Take care.
You too.
When the moon's behind a hill, when the moon's behind a hill,